regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We're going to talk about the oral arguments in U.S. versus Hamani, which took place on Monday morning. 2 hours of oral arguments and really fascinating stuff. You know, if I had to give you my initial impression, I would say that I think Section 922G3, which prohibits gun possession by all unlawful users of drugs and those who are addicted to drugs, I think that a majority of the court is likely to say that that law is unconstitutional, at least as it applies to Ali Daniel Hamani, the defendant in this case. I think we're likely to see a very different coalition in the majority than what we saw in Bruin back in 2022, and perhaps even in Rahimi as well, though that was pretty broad. Biggest surprise for me is that, maybe it shouldn't be a surprise, but Justice Samuel Alito seemed very much on the side of the government during oral arguments, continued to raise the idea that if the law does not apply, in this case to Ali Daniel Hamani, that there must be an individualized finding for everybody charged under Section 922G3, which, of course, the government agreed with. Aaron Murphy, representing Mr. Hamani before the High Court, disagreed, said, no, there is a categorical way to ban individuals who use a particular drug. But in order to do so, there needs to be some sort of fact-finding involved as to why the use of that drug is so dangerous that an individual cannot habitually use it, which is the phrase that the government considers unlawful, right? You have to be a habitual user. That the mere habitual use of that drug does make somebody so dangerous that they pose a particularized danger of owning a gun. Typically, we'd be looking at, you know, the effects of that drug, right? Ayahuasca was brought up a couple of times during the oral arguments, the very powerful hallucinogenic drug, which I don't know if you could get addicted to that, but certainly while you're under the influence, you're kind of divorced from reality. Maybe that applies after the fact. There were a lot of various issues that were raised. But really the justices who seemed to signal most clearly, their acceptance of the government's position, Justice Sam Alito and Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Clarence Thomas didn't ask a lot of questions. So it's kind of hard to see where he's coming down, but just based on the questions that were asked, I would say that, the liberal wing of the court, seems to take issue with 922G3 and seems to take issue with the government's argument. And we'll get into Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson's disagreement in a little bit, because I think that was pretty substantial. But Justice Sotomayor, for example, noted that, you know, Congress says unlawful users of drugs are prohibited from owning firearms, but nowhere is that defined, that phrase. And brought up the vagueness of the statute. Actually, I questioned Aaron Murphy why the defendants, rather, weren't making as much of an issue of the vagueness of the statute. And Aaron Murphy said, well, actually, that was a big part of our reply brief. But even if the statute is not deemed void for vagueness, and that was actually one of the first arguments she raised in her opening statement, is that, yeah, facially, it is unconstitutional because it's so vague. But certainly, as it applies to Ali Daniel Hamani, it is unconstitutional because the analogy that the government uses is not the right analogy. And so, getting back to the government's case, the chief contention is that back at the time of the founding, you had statutes that barred habitual drunkards from possessing firearms. And in some cases, you know, far worse than that. And she says that there is a post-ratification history that ties directly to that. Statutes dealing with the unlawful use of drugs or drug addiction, and the prohibition on gun ownership. I thought one of Aaron Murphy's strongest arguments in rebuttal to the government's position is that those historical statutes dealt with drunkards, not drinkers. Early on in the oral arguments, I believe it was Justice Gorsuch who noted drinking was common at the time of the founding, right? John Adams had a tankard of cider every morning. Thomas Jefferson talked about his moderate drinking, which generally meant 4 to 5 glasses of wine a night. There was a early temperance society that actually talked about 8 shots of whiskey a day not being habitual, but perhaps twice as many, 16 shots of whiskey a day would indicate that, oh yeah, you know, you got a problem with alcohol. Whereas 922G3 doesn't talk about the quantity of unlawful drugs that are used or the frequency of unlawful drugs. The government suggests that it's, again, a habitual thing, that it's on a regular basis, and that occasional drug users would not fall under Section 922G3. But it is at least open to interpretation that, no, you don't have to be falling down drunk as habitual drunkards were. You don't have to have this intoxicating substance have such a control over your life that even in those brief periods of sobriety, you simply can't be trusted to possess a firearm. This is so much more broad than what habitual drunkard statutes did at the time of the founding that it is not the appropriate analogy. In fact, there is no appropriate analog, according to Aaron Murphy. I thought that was a really strong argument. Several of the justices, including Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who I think is also likely to side with the defendants in this case and against the government, talked about the scheduling of drugs. Right now, marijuana, of course, is classified as Schedule 1, right? Congress made that determination, by the way. So, again, if we're talking about, you know, how do we determine whether or not a drug is dangerous, as Aaron Murphy noted, Congress is already having to do that under the Controlled Substances Act. And if somebody wants to raise a challenge to Congress's findings, they have the ability to do so under the APA, the Administrative Procedures Act. Unlike Section 922G3, where if the government says, you know, you're an unlawful user, you don't get to challenge that definition of habitual or posing a particularized danger to the community. So Justice Amy Coney Barrett noted that, you know, as you get down past Schedule 1 and Schedule 2, you get into Schedule 3, Schedule 4, Schedule 5, are all of these drugs dangerous? Does the unlawful use of these drugs, and she brought up, you know, Robitussin, Adderall, which I believe is Schedule 2, does the unlawful use, even if you mean that means habitually, right? Twice a week, you're taking your roommate's Adderall to help you with your history exam, I think was the example that either Justice Baird or maybe Justice Kavanaugh gave. Does that automatically make you dangerous? And the government had a really difficult time explaining why their position was yes, it does. It kind of touched on, well, the you know it's unlawful, right? And if you know that this is unlawful and you're doing it anyway, then that suggests that, you know, again, perhaps you're a dangerous individual when it comes to gun ownership. Justice Amy Coney Barrett also mentioned the wife who has a prescription for Ambien, the husband who takes a couple of those pills every so often, let's say once or twice a week, to help him go to sleep. Can he be barred from possessing a firearm, but she, it's okay? And again, the government's position was yes, because he's the one who's taking Ambien without a prescription. Even though, again, there's no particularized finding that Ambien is makes somebody dangerous. The government says that the defendant's arguments were all over the place. I thought the government's arguments were all over the place, quite honestly. They kept talking about that post-ratification history and the importance of the post-ratification history. But as Aaron Murphy noted, the vast majority of statutes, both you know, when illegal drugs really started to become a problem at the late 1800s, early 1900s to today, the vast majority of these statutes that prohibited gun ownership for these individuals, for this class of individuals, based that prohibition on addiction and not simple use. And today, I think she said there are only 8 states that ban gun possession for the use of unlawful drugs, whereas most states, again, talk about the addiction, talk about an adjudication of having a controlled substance abuse. But they, again, the vast majority of them do not go as far as what the 922G3 says. So, again, I think it's going to be a really interesting decision. If I had to predict right now, I would say that Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson are all going to side with Ali Daniel Hamani. I think Justice Amy Coney Barrett is going to side with Hamani. I think Justice Kavanaugh is going to side with Hamani. I think Justice Gorsuch is going to side with Hamani. I think Clarence Thomas is kind of a cipher. And I think Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito will side with the government. So I think we're looking at least a 6-3 decision, perhaps a 7-2 decision, that Section 922G3 is unconstitutional as it is applied to Ali Daniel Hamani. And it may be a very narrow decision. In fact, Justice Gorsuch had asked at one point, asked Aaron Murphy, like, you know, do we really need to wrestle with, you know, congressional findings and individualized findings of dangerousness, and what's the standard going to be used? I mean, can't we just narrowly say that here are the facts for Ali Daniel Hamani? The government says that he admitted to using pot, you know, every other day. But we don't know how much he smokes or imbibes. We don't know how many times during that day that he's, you know, using marijuana, how many times he's using it. We don't know the quality. We don't know, right, the THC amount. We don't know anything other than every other day, Ali Daniel Hamani says he smokes pot. Is that enough to make him a dangerous person, right? Because inherent in the government's argument about the unlawful use of drugs, you have to be a habitual user. And when we get into habitual, it's not just the frequency of use, believe it or not. It is the because again, if that was the case, then back in the day, the vast majority of the country could have been disarmed as habitual drinkers, right? But the statute back then was habitual drunkards. It's about how this intoxicating substance impacts your life, and the habitual use of this intoxicating substance impacts your life. Does it make you a dangerous person, a more dangerous person than you would be otherwise? And Justice Gorsuch certainly seemed to suggest that he did not think that the facts of this case show that Ali Daniel Hamani is a more dangerous person because he uses marijuana every other day. So I think that you may see, again, depending on who ultimately writes this opinion. I mean, if Justice Gorsuch is the author, I think it is going to be a very narrow decision, and it'll leave a lot open to the lower courts to keep hashing out on their own. You could see, I suppose, I don't think Justice Jackson is going to get to write the majority opinion, even if she might write a concurring opinion, but Justice Jackson's position really seemed to be anti-Bruin and to some extent anti-Rahimi. She doesn't like the text history and tradition test. She really doesn't. And that was her problem. She noted that, you know, in Wolford versus Lopez, the DOJ took the position that these poaching laws from the, you know, 1700s were not close enough to Hawaii's vampire rule to serve as analogs. But now they're saying that these, you know, 18th century laws regarding habitual drunkards is enough to bar anybody who, you know, smokes pot a couple of times a week from owning a firearm, or who, you know, takes a couple of their spouse's Ambien. I don't know that she's going to get a lot of support for her belief that we need to return to this sort of, you know, tiered scrutiny analysis, right? Which typically, of course, relied on intermediate scrutiny. As long as the government, essentially, as long as the government could show that they had a real interest in regulating firearms in a particular way, and all they had to basically say was public safety, then the government generally said, okay, that's fine, right? They didn't have to narrowly tailor these prohibitions. Although Aaron Murphy did argue that, look, even if you want to go old school and you want to do the tiered scrutiny analysis, we're talking about a fundamental right, so strict scrutiny should be the right standard. But this is, again, so overly broad that even under intermediate scrutiny, the government would not be able to justify the language of 922G3. Again, I think Justice Alito is firmly in the DOJ's camp. I think he foresees if it's okay for Ali Daniel Hamani to use marijuana and own a gun. I think he just sees this wreaking havoc in the courts where everybody charged with 922G3 is going to argue, hey, listen, I'm not a danger, even though I used, you know, whatever drug it is, because X, Y, and Z. And maybe that is going to be the case. I mean, maybe it is. Aaron Murphy suggested, though, that, you know, look, there are definitions that can be provided to a jury. So it doesn't have to be a judicial determination, right? But a jury already has to determine whether or not somebody is an unlawful user of drugs as the government defines it, or whether or not they're an addict. So there's already this individualized finding. It's not going to wreak havoc with the courts because we're already seeing this. She noted that, you know, if you're involved in a guardianship or a civil commitment for somebody who's an addict, you again are going to have to make that individualized determination about whether or not somebody truly is an addict. And those determinations are already being made in these cases. I want to go back and just look through my notes real quick, make sure I'm not missing any of the big line of arguments. Let's see. Justice Barrett talked about, again, the dangerousness for each type of drugs. For each type of drug, what's the government's evidence that using marijuana a couple times a week makes them dangerous? DOJ talked about the potential for abuse, the potential for addiction, the effect on mental capacity, the ability to use firearms safely, even when you're sober. Justice Gorsuch asked whether or not the DOJ was arguing that it, you know, illegal drug use is dangerous per se because it is illegal. Justice Alito, you know, arguing that basically this is an unprecedented societal concern. And so that even if the habitual drunkard statutes from history are not analogs, or at least close enough analogs, he said that, you know, most common illegal drugs hadn't been invented at the time of the ratification of the Second Amendment or the 14th Amendment. So we don't know what the founders would have thought about illegal drug use per se. He said he asked if the regulation of alcohol is analogous to a regulation of illegal drugs, or does it not have a different place in history and the culture of the West, suggesting that even at the time of the founding, let's say that, you know, people were quaffing back a pint of cider at breakfast every day or a bottle and a half of wine every night, that would have been seen as different than, you know, farmers smoking a little homegrown at the end of the evening every night if marijuana had been used at the time. Or you know, harder drugs. And the DOJ's position was, yes, essentially. You know, this is why the post-ratification history is so difficult, she said, for the respondents here, because that there has been this, you know, chain throughout our nation's history of prohibiting gun possession for these individuals. Now, again, I think Aaron Murphy handled it very well. I don't think it proved to be all that problematic at all. As she noted, the vast majority of statutes from history and the vast majority of statutes today address addiction. And Aaron Murphy said, look, we don't have a problem with the government saying that somebody who is addicted to drugs, and again, the definition of addiction in the Controlled Substances Act is not just somebody who regularly uses drugs, but somebody who I think is a danger to the public morals is how they define it, because of their habitual drug use. And Aaron Murphy, you know, suggested, like, I mean, look, if the government can prove that, okay. But again, in order to prove that, you're going to have an individualized finding that this individual's drug use makes them a danger to the public morals, however that is defined. So, I mean, listen, I think the government had a really tough challenge ahead of it, in part because of the way that 922G3 is written. And the government can talk about the assumptions that are made about what habitual or excuse me, what unlawful really means. And maybe the courts have settled on, you know, the idea that it involves some sort of habitual drug use, but they haven't really settled on what habitual means. So you're replacing one problem with another, right? These terms are not defined by the statute. So there is a real vagueness problem. But as Aaron Murphy pointed out, there is also a problem with using drunkard statutes as the historical analog for banning unlawful users of drugs. Because those drunkards were not everybody who regularly consumed alcohol. If it was that broad, again, the vast majority of the adult population in the United States could have been deprived of their right to keep and bear arms. The drunkard was somebody, A, who habitually used alcohol, and B, could not manage themselves, posed a problem to society because of their drinking. And that's why the state had to step in. Yep, listen, Thomas Jefferson might be able to pound back a bottle and a half of wine every night, but I'm sorry, Gary. You know, you become quite belligerent after you've had a couple of glasses of port or Madeira. That's the difference between the habitual drunkard and the habitual drinker. And I think in that respect, it is a distinction with a difference. And 922G3 does not deal with the modern day equivalent of the drunkard. At least, well, it does, but in the addict portion of 922G3. By including the unlawful user of drugs, you are then going further afield from where the national tradition of regulation lies. And you are wrapping in people who do not pose a problem. They are not a particular danger because of their unlawful drug use. The granny who takes a gummy to sleep at night doesn't really pose a danger to the public at large. The prosecutor in Pennsylvania who wants people to own a firearm but can't because he uses cannabis to help him deal with anxiety, stress. He doesn't pose a danger to the public. And again, you can have somebody who, let's say once a month, you know, gets out of their mind, whether on alcohol, or, you know, let's say a powerful hallucinogenic like LSD. Even if they get behind the wheel of their car when they are intoxicated, that's not alone. And that enough is not alone to say, listen, they become a dangerous person, right? Because it's only once a month. It's not habitual. So I do hope that the court strikes down the statute facially because it is so vague and so ill-defined. I don't know that that's going to happen. I don't know that the court wants to get to a position where it opens the door, however temporarily, at least until Congress can act, where everybody who unlawfully uses drugs has the right to do so under the Second Amendment. I don't know that there's a majority of the court that would go along with that. But I do think that we're likely to see the court come down on the side, again, however narrowly, that in the case of Ali Daniel Hamani, and perhaps in the case of others, whether it's individuals who only use marijuana, whether it's, lower categories of drugs like Schedule 4, Schedule 5, But that at least in some cases, there needs to be some type of determination that either the drug in question makes somebody so dangerous that it's unlawful use, does allow for them to be prohibited from owning a firearm, or that there is an individualized finding of some sort that the individual in question's drug use makes them too dangerous to own a gun. I couldn't tell you how broad or narrow that decision is going to be. I'm not sure that the justices could tell you today how broad or narrow that decision will be. I think it's entirely possible we have a majority opinion and a concurring opinion. In fact, I think that would be likely, because I don't know that Justice Jackson is just going to go along with the majority. I think she's going to want to have her say. And we could have more than one concurring opinion, but I feel reasonably confident that a majority of the court is going to find in favor of Ali Daniel Hamani. How much more they're willing to do beyond that, I think, is very much an open question. So that's my take on the oral arguments today. And I tell you what, I'm going to be off tomorrow. So Wednesday, we'll get back to the regular program with the Armed Citizen Story, the Good Deed of the Day, the Recidivist Report. But today, I did just want to kind of focus on the Hamani oral arguments. Should mention the other action from the court today. We did get the orders from last Friday's conference, and really very little news. Nothing on the hardware ban cases. So they will presumably be relisted. That's not the worst news. I am very disappointed that Melinda Vincent's cert petition was officially denied. I suspect this is a 922G1 case. This is a case Melinda Vincent, I think, wrote a bad check 17 years ago. Got probation, but she could have been punished by more than a year in jail, so she's lost her Second Amendment rights. I have a feeling that the court, at least in general, has accepted the government's argument that, hey, listen, there's going to be this rights restoration process opening up very soon, and individuals like Melinda Vincent can apply to have her rights restored. And honestly, in this case, it's probably not going to be a difficult call for the AG to restore her Second Amendment rights. I have a feeling that the government is willing to go along with that, at least for now, which is why we have seen a bunch of 922G1 cases rejected by the court over the past couple of months. They hung on to Melinda Vincent's for a little bit longer for some reason, and so maybe there was, you know, some special consideration. I would have really liked to have seen the court grant cert in her case, but unfortunately, again, it looks like the court has decided to wait and see what the DOJ's rights restoration process looks like. I would note that it is still not officially open. I mean, we saw, I think it was last week, the DOJ did pardon 22 other individuals, but it wasn't through this portal because the portal doesn't exist yet. So I hope, the DOJ said it would likely be live sometime this month, sometime in March. I hope that that's the case. And I hope that Melinda Vincent is among those who quickly put in their application. I have it reviewed by the Attorney General, and I hope that Melinda Vincent will regain her right to keep and bear arms very, very soon, despite the court's decision today. All right, so we'll see you back here on Wednesday for the next edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Thank you again for listening to the analysis of today's oral arguments in U.S. versus Hamani. When we might see a court decision, late June, I think this will be one of the later cases that will be decided by the court. But again, I think we're likely to see a very odd coalition. It's not going to be the same makeup as what we saw in Bruin. I think that is pretty much guaranteed by what we heard from Justice Alito and Chief Justice Roberts today. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today and tomorrow. Even though I'm off, Tom Knighton's going to hold down the fort, and we've got more stories and more news outside of Hamani to cover. Just check out BearingArms.com. If you like what you see, we'd also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code FIGHT and get 60% off your membership. You'll be supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms, and you'll also get some fantastic benefits. Again, just use that promo code FIGHT when you go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. Have a great rest of your Monday. I'll see you back here on Wednesday. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.